Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Earlier this May, Chinese President Xi Jinping said, Hong Kong scientists could seek government money to fund their research. It is the first time since 1997 that Hong Kong researchers have been permitted to request money from the Chinese government. But the official Xinhua news agency said those seeking such support must show they love the country and Hong Kong. Some Hong Kong researchers are worried the requirement is a patriotism test that could interfere with their work. More than 20 individuals and education groups started a petition protesting the measure. The petition said the term love the country and Hong Kong was unclear, and it said making researchers show their loyalty could limit freedom of thought and study. Signers to the petition also worried the order could be extended to people working in other areas, the law, for example, or history and written works. But Hong Kong's top official, Carrie Lam, said people had misunderstood the order. Lam told reporters, "Of course, in Hong Kong, we do expect, whether you are a scientist or researcher, or government official like myself, to love our country and love Hong Kong. So that is nothing unusual." Lam aims to help make Hong Kong a worldwide center for research and discovery. As of this Monday, some researchers said they still were not sure whether evidence of patriotism was required to seek government money. They also noted that past Chinese government attempts to establish patriotism among Hong Kong's people had failed. For example, 6 years ago, more than 100,000 protesters objected to a proposed school program designed to make Hong Kong children feel good about China. In time, the Hong Kong government canceled the program. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
For hundreds of years, visitors to Scotland's Loch Ness have described seeing a creature that some people believe lives deep in the lake. But now the story of Nessie, the Loch Ness monster, may have no place to hide. A New Zealand scientist is leading an international team to the lake next month. They plan to take some of the water and study genetic material from the lake to see what species live there. Neil Gemmell is a professor at the University of Otago in Dunedin, New Zealand. The 51-year-old researcher says he does not believe all the stories about Nessie, but he says he wants to take people on an interesting trip and communicate some science to them along the way. Besides, he added, his children think it is one of the coolest things he has ever done. One of the more unusual theories is that Nessie is a long-necked dinosaur that somehow survived after other dinosaurs died out. Another theory is that the creature is actually a large fish, such as a sturgeon or giant catfish. Many people believe the claims of sightings are tricks, or can be explained by trees floating in the water or strong winds. Gemmel said that when creatures move in water, they leave behind small pieces of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. DNA is found in the cells of all animals and plants. It carries their genetic information. DNA comes from their skin, hair, and waste fluids. The New Zealand researcher said his team will take water from different points around the lake and at different depths. After removing the organic material, they will take the DNA and sequence it by using technology created for the Human Genome Project. The goal of that project was the complete mapping and understanding of all the genes of human beings. Gemmel said the results of his team's DNA tests will then be compared against all known species. He said they should have answers by the end of the year. I'm going into this thinking it is unlikely there is a monster, but I want to test that hypothesis, Gemmel said, adding that the results will also show the biodiversity of the Loch Ness. He noted that the real discoveries may come in finding things like the number of invasive species. Gemmel said he first visited Loch Ness when he was in his late 20s. Like thousands of visitors before him, he looked out over the lake trying to see a monster. He said he first came up with the idea of testing DNA from the lake a few years ago, and many people liked it, including his children. Graham Matheson, chief of the Scottish Society of New Zealand, said he too had visited Loch Ness and looked for a monster. I hope he and his cohorts find something, although I think they'll be battling, Matheson said. Still, it's a good way to get a trip to Scotland. Gemmel said that even if his team fails to find any monster DNA, it won't stop some Nessie believers. He said they have already been offering him theories. One idea is that Nessie might have left the lake and, after a lot of swimming, gone somewhere else for a rest. Another theory is that the monster might be an extraterrestrial, perhaps coming from another planet, and not leave behind any DNA. In our lives, we want there still to be mysteries, some of which we will solve, Gemmel said, adding that sometimes we find what we were not expecting to find. I'm Susan Shand.
Nearly every week, we hear news about the latest successes and failures in driverless vehicles. But we hear little about how other industries are developing this same kind of technology. One industry heavily involved in researching and developing artificial intelligence, or AI, is agriculture. Companies are experimenting with high-tech tools that can help farmers save time and money while reducing environment-harming chemicals. One of the companies is Echo Robotics of Switzerland. It created a robot equipped with AI and cameras to identify all plants on a farm. The robot has four wheels to carry it through the fields in search of weeds. Computer-controlled arms then lower and spray the weeds with small amounts of herbicide. Company officials say the robot can fully operate on its own for up to 12 hours a day while being powered by the sun. It uses the same kind of sensor and positioning technology used to guide driverless vehicles. A farmer can also control the equipment through a smartphone. The co-founder of Echo Robotics, Urlian Demore, says the farm robot can kill weeds with 20 times less herbicide than traditional methods. This is because the system uses exactly the right amount of chemical in the exact place required to kill the weeds. Currently, farmers spread weed killers over massive areas to destroy unwanted plants. This method led to a huge industry of genetically engineered crop products created to resist herbicides. The process of changing the genetic structure of food crops has been debated for some time. Such foods are commonly called GMOs, for genetically modified organisms, or GEs, meaning genetically edited. Critics of genetically engineered crops believe they can harm people. Large chemical companies have been criticized for supporting genetic crop engineering in order to keep driving herbicide sales. Urlian Demore says the Echo Robotics system can revolutionize farming by greatly reducing chemical usage while operating without additional equipment or people. The company is planning to bring its robot to the market by early next year. Another company developing farm robotics is California-based Blue River Technology. The company has a system called See & Spray, which it claims was the world's first smart sprayer. The system, which connects to the back of a tractor, is also equipped with AI to identify and chemically kill only the weeds. It can also spray chemicals on wanted plants to help them grow. Ben Chostner is the Vice President of Business Development for Blue River Technology. He explains in a company video that See & Spray technology uses the same deep learning methods used in facial recognition.
The first time we saw a pigweed, the machine didn't know what kind of plant it was, but we taught it by giving it tens of thousands of examples of that pigweed, and now it's an expert in pigweed.
Chostner adds that the technology gives farmers much more control over the management of their crops. This is because they can get a full picture of exactly what weeds are present to be able to design the best plan for getting rid of them. The company says its technology can kill the same number of weeds with just 10% of the amount of herbicide currently used to spray whole fields. Last year, major American tractor company John Deere and Company bought Blue River for $305 million. In a statement at the time, John Deere said the deal demonstrated a commitment to develop machine learning technology in future products. Germany's electronics company Bosch and chemical manufacturer Bayer have also teamed up to research smart spraying technology. But Bayer is also one of the world's largest seeds and pesticides producers. Economic experts say Bayer's deal with Bosch is aimed at preparing the business for major reductions in herbicide sales when new smart agriculture solutions are widely used. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On November 11, 1918, a truce was signed ending the hostilities of World War I. The Central Powers, led by Germany, had lost. The Allies, led by Britain, France, and the United States, had won. The war lasted 4 years. It took the lives of 10 million people. It left much of Europe in ruins. It was described as the war to end all wars. Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson tell about President Woodrow Wilson and his part in events after the war.
The immediate task was to seek agreement on terms of a peace treaty. The Allies were filled with bitter anger. They demanded a treaty that would punish Germany severely. They wanted to make Germany weak by destroying its military and industry. And they wanted to ruin Germany's economy by making it pay all war damages. Germany, they said, must never go to war again. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States did not agree completely with the other allies. He wanted a peace treaty based on justice, not bitterness. He believed that would produce a lasting peace. President Wilson had led negotiations for a truce to end the hostilities of World War I. Now, he hoped to play a major part in negotiations for a peace treaty. To be effective, he needed the full support of the American people.
Americans had supported Wilson's policies through most of the war. They had accepted what was necessary to win. This meant higher taxes and shortages of goods. At the time, Americans seemed to forget party politics. Democrats and Republicans worked together. All that changed when it became clear the war was ending. Congressional elections were to be held in November 1918. President Wilson was a Democrat. He feared that Republicans might gain a majority of seats in Congress. If they did, his negotiating powers at a peace conference in Europe would be weakened. Wilson told the nation, "The return of a Republican majority to either House of Congress would be seen by foreign leaders as a rejection of my leadership."
Republicans protested. They charged that Wilson's appeal to voters was an insult to every Republican. One party leader said, "This is not the president's private war." The Republican campaign succeeded. The party won control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The congressional elections were a defeat for President Wilson, but he did not let the situation interfere with his plans for a peace conference. He and the other Allied leaders agreed to meet in Paris in January 1919.
In the weeks before the conference, Wilson chose members of his negotiating team. Everyone expected him to include one or more senators. After all, the Senate would vote to approve or reject the final peace treaty. Wilson refused. Instead, he chose several close advisors to go with him to Paris. Today, American history experts say Wilson's decision was a mistake. Failure to put senators on the negotiating team, they say, cost him valuable support later on. In early December, President Wilson sailed to France. The voyage across the Atlantic Ocean lasted 9 days. He arrived at the port of Brest on December 13th. Wilson felt very happy. 13, he said, was his lucky number.
French citizens stood along the railroad that carried him from Brest to Paris. They cheered as his train passed. In Paris, cannons were fired to announce his arrival, and a huge crowd welcomed him there. The people shouted his name over and over again. Wilson, Wilson, Wilson. The noise sounded like thunder. French Premier Georges Clemenceau commented on the event. He said, "I do not think there has been anything like it in the history of the world." People cheered President Wilson partly to thank America for sending its troops to help fight against Germany. But many French citizens and other Europeans also shared Wilson's desire to establish a new world of peace. They listened with hope as he made an emotional speech about a world in which everyone would reject hatred, a world in which everyone would join together to end war forever.
More than 25 nations that helped win the war sent representatives to the peace conference in Paris. All took part in the negotiations. However, the important decisions were made by the so-called Big Four: Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, Premier Vittorio Orlando of Italy, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Wilson hoped the other Allied leaders would accept his plan for a new international organization. The organization would be called the League of Nations. Wilson believed the League could prevent future wars by deciding fair settlements of disputes between nations. He believed it would be the world's only hope for a lasting peace.
Most of the other representatives did not have Wilson's faith in the power of peace. Yet they supported his plan for the League of Nations. However, they considered it less important than completing a peace treaty with Germany, and they did not want to spend much time talking about it. They feared that negotiations on the League might delay the treaty and the rebuilding of Europe. Wilson was firm. He demanded that the peace treaty also establish the League. So he led a group at the conference that wrote a plan for the operation of the League. He gave the plan to the European leaders to consider. Then he returned to the United States for a brief visit.
President Wilson soon learned that opposition to the League of Nations existed on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Many Americans opposed it strongly. Some Republican senators began criticizing it even before Wilson's ship reached the port of Boston. The senators said the plan failed to recognize America's long-term interests. They said it would take away too many powers from national governments. 37 senators signed a resolution saying the United States should reject the plan for the League of Nations. That was more than the number of votes needed to defeat a peace treaty to which Wilson hoped the League plan would be linked.
The Senate resolution hurt Wilson politically. It was a sign to the rest of the world that he did not have the full support of his people. But he returned to Paris anyway. He got more bad news when he arrived. Wilson's top advisor at the Paris Peace Conference was Colonel Edward House. Colonel House had continued negotiations while Wilson was back in the United States. House agreed with Wilson on most issues. Unlike Wilson, however, he believed the Allies' most urgent need was to reach agreement on a peace treaty with Germany. To do this, House was willing to make many more compromises than Wilson on details for the League of Nations.
Wilson was furious when he learned what House had done. He said, "Colonel House has given away everything I had won before I left Paris. He has compromised until nothing remains. Now I have to start all over again. This time it will be more difficult." For Woodrow Wilson, the most difficult negotiations still lay ahead.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.